else calling from California. Sir, you're more than welcome anytime. You have a wonderful day now. We're going
Thank you
on.
So much, Gary.
Much more than
have
welcome.
A wonderful day, too. Thank you.
You too, sir. Beautiful.
They smile in your face all the time. Wanna take your place, the backstabbers.
they smiling in your face all the time. Wanna take your place, the backstabbers. Listen, all you fellas who have some more and you really care. Yeah, yeah.
Can I tell you your fellas who better beware? Yeah, yeah.
They smiling in your face all the time. Wanna take your place, the backstabbers.
What they do,
they smiling
faces, smiling faces, sometimes tell us,
smiling your face,
smile on me, low down, dirty lies,
Senate Resolution 488. The Senate has provided for up to 4 hours of closing arguments equally divided between the managers on the part of the House of Representatives and counsel and the counsel for the President. Pursuant to Rule 22 of the Rules of Procedure and Practice in the Senate when sitting on impeachment trials, the argument shall be opened and closed on the part of the House of Representatives. The presiding officer recognizes Mr. Manager Schiff to begin the presentation on the part of the House of Representatives.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the U.S. Senate, counsel for the President, almost 170 years ago, Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts took to the well of the old Senate chamber, not far from where I'm standing. He delivered what would become perhaps his most famous address, the 7th of March speech. Webster sought to rally his colleagues to adopt the Compromise of 1850, a package of legislation that he and others hoped would forestall a civil war brewing over the question of slavery. He said, It is fortunate that there is a Senate of the United States, a body not yet moved from its propriety, not lost to a just sense of its own dignity and its own high responsibilities, and a body to which the country looks with confidence for wise, moderate, patriotic, and healing counsels. It is not to be denied that we live in the midst of strong agitations and are surrounded by very considerable dangers to our institutions of government. The imprisoned winds are let loose, but I have a duty to perform, and I mean to perform it with fidelity, not without a sense of surrounding dangers, but not without hope. Webster was wrong to believe that the Compromise of 1850 could prevent secession of the South, but I hope he was not wrong to put his faith in the Senate. Because the design of the Constitution and the intention of the framers was that the Senate would be a chamber removed from the sway of temporary political winds. In Federalist 65, Hamilton wrote, quote, "Where else than in the Senate could have been found a tribunal sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent? What other body would be likely to feel confidence enough in its own situation to preserve, unawed and uninfluenced, the necessary impartiality between an individual accused and the representatives of the people, his accusers?" In the same essay, Hamilton explained this about impeachment. "The subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be dominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. The prosecution of them, for this reason, will seldom fail to agitate the passions of the whole community, and to divide it into parties more or less friendly or inimical to the accused. In such cases, there will always be the greatest danger that the decision will be regulated more by the comparative strength of parties than by the real demonstrations of innocence or guilt." Daniel Webster and Alexander Hamilton placed their hopes in you, the Senate, to be the court of greatest impartiality, to be a neutral representative of the people in determining, uninfluenced by party or pre-existing faction, the innocence or guilt of the President of the United States. Today, you have a duty to perform with fidelity, not without a sense of surrounding dangers, but also not without hope. I submit to you on behalf of the House of Representatives that your duty demands that you convict President Trump. Now, I don't pretend that this is an easy process. It's not designed to be easy. It shouldn't be easy to impeach or convict a president. Impeachment is an extraordinary remedy, a tool only to be used in rare instances of grave misconduct. But it is in the Constitution for a reason. In America, no one is above the law, even those elected President of the United States. And I would say, especially those elected President of the United States. You've heard arguments from the President's counsel that impeachment would overturn the results of the 2016 election. You have heard that in seeking the removal and disqualification of the President, the House is seeking to interfere in the next election. Senators, neither is true. And these arguments demonstrate a deeply misguided, or I think intentional, effort to mislead about the role that impeachment plays in our democracy. If you believe, as we do, and as we have proven, that the President's efforts to use his official powers to cheat in the 2020 election jeopardize our national security and are antithetical to our democratic tradition, then you must come to no other conclusion that the President threatens the fairness of the next election and risk putting foreign interference between the voters and their ballots. Professor Dershowitz and the other counselors to the president have argued that if the president thinks that something is in his interest, then it is by definition in the interest of the American people. We have said throughout this process that we cannot and should not leave our common sense at the door. The logical conclusion this argument is that the president is the state, that his interests are the nation's interests, that his will is necessarily ours. You and I and the American people know otherwise. And we do not have to be constitutional scholars to understand that this is a position deeply at odds with our Constitution and our democracy. that believing in this argument or allowing the president to get away with misconduct based on this extreme view would render him above the law. But we know that this cannot be true. What you decide on these articles will have lasting implications for the future of the presidency, not only for this president, but for all future presidents. Whether or not the office of the presidency of the United States of America is above the law, that is the question. As Alexis de Tocqueville wrote in his 1835 work, Democracy in America, quote, "The greatness of America lies not in being made more enlightened than any other nation, but rather in her ability to repair her faults." In May of 1974, Barry Goldwater and other Republican congressional leaders went to the White House to tell President Nixon that it was time for him to resign and that they could no longer hold back the tide of impeachment over Watergate. Now, contrary to popular belief, the Republican Party did not abandon Nixon as the Watergate scandal came to light. It took years of disclosures and crisis and court battles. The party stood with Nixon through Watergate because he was a popular conservative president and his base was with him. So they were too. But ultimately, as Goldwater would tell Nixon, quote, "There are only so many lies you can take, and now there have been one too many." The president would have us believe that he did not withhold aid to coerce these sham investigations, that his July 25th call with the Ukrainians was perfect, that his meeting with President Zelensky on the sidelines of the UN is no different than a head of state meeting in the Oval Office, that his only interest in having Ukraine announce investigations into the Bidens was an altruistic concern over corruption, that the Ukrainians interfered in our 2016 election, not Russia, that Putin knows better than our own intelligence agencies. How many falsehoods can we take? When will it be one too many? Let us take a few minutes to remind you one last time of the facts of the president's misconduct as you consider how you'll vote on this important matter for our nation. Those facts compel the president's conviction on the two articles of impeachment.
Mr. Chief Justice and Senators, over the past 2 weeks, the House has presented to you overwhelming and unconverted evidence that President Trump has committed grave abuses of power that harmed our national security and were intended to defraud our elections. President Trump abused the extraordinary powers he alone holds as President of the United States to coerce an ally to interfere in our upcoming presidential election for the benefit of his own reelection. He then used those unique powers to wage an unprecedented campaign to obstruct Congress and cover up his wrongdoing. As the president's scheme to corrupt our election progressed over several months, it became, as one witness described, more insidious. The president and his agents wielded the powers of the presidency and the full weight of the U.S. government to increase pressure on Ukraine's new president to coerce him to announce two sham investigations that would smear his potential election opponent and raise his political standing. By early September of last year, the president's pressure campaign appeared on the verge of succeeding, until that is, the president got caught and the scheme was exposed. In response, President Trump ordered a massive cover-up, unprecedented in American history. He tried to conceal the facts from Congress, using every tool and legal window dressing he could to block evidence and muzzle witnesses. He tried to prevent the public from learning how he placed himself above country. And yet, even as President Trump has orchestrated this cover-up and obstructed Congress's impeachment inquiry, he remains unapologetic, unrestrained, and intent on continuing his sham to defraud our elections. As I stand here today, delivering the House's closing argument, President Trump's constitutional crimes, his crimes against the American people and the nation, remain in progress. As you make your final determination on the president's guilt, it is therefore worth revisiting the totality of the president's misconduct. Doing so lays bare the ongoing threat President Trump poses to our democratic system of government, both to our upcoming election that some suggest should be the arbiter of the president's misconduct, and to the Constitution itself that we all swore to support and defend. Donald Trump was the central player in the corrupt scheme assisted principally by his private attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Early in 2019, Giuliani conspired with two corrupt former Ukrainian prosecutors to fabricate and promote phony investigations of wrongdoing by former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as the Russian propaganda that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that hacked the DNC in 2016. In the course of their presentation to you, the president's counsel have made several remarkable admissions that affirm core elements of this scheme, including specifically about Giuliani's role and representation of the president. The president's counsel has conceded that Giuliani sought to convince Ukraine to investigate the Bidens and allege Ukraine election interference on behalf of his client, the president, and that the president's focus on these sham investigations was significantly informed by Giuliani, whose views the president adopted. Compounding this damning admission, the president's counsel has also conceded that Giuliani was not conducting foreign policy on behalf of the president. They have confirmed that in pursuing these two investigations, Giuliani was working solely in the president's private personal interest. And the president's personal interest is now clear: to cheat in the next election. As Giuliani would later admit, for the president's scheme to succeed, he first needed to remove the American ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, an anti-corruption champion Giuliani viewed as an obstacle who, and I quote, was going to make the investigations difficult for everybody. Working with now indicted associates Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, Giuliani orchestrated a bogus, months-long smear campaign against the ambassador that culminated in her removal in April. The president's sudden order to remove our ambassador came just 3 days after Ukraine's presidential election in late April, which saw a reformer, Volodymyr Zelensky, swept into office on an anti-corruption platform. President Trump called to congratulate Zelensky right after his victory. He invited President Zelensky to the White House and agreed to send Vice President Pence to his inauguration. But 3 weeks later, after Rudy Giuliani was denied a meeting with President Zelensky, President Trump abruptly ordered Vice President Pence to cancel his trip. Instead, a lower-level delegation led by three of President Trump's political appointees, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland, and Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations Kurt Volker, attended Zelensky's inauguration the following week. These three returned from Ukraine impressed with President Zelensky. In a meeting shortly thereafter with President Trump in the Oval Office, they relayed their positive impression of the new Ukrainian president and encouraged President Trump to schedule the White House meeting he promised in his first call. But President Trump reacted negatively. He railed that Ukraine tried to take me down in 2016, and in order to schedule a White House visit for President Zelensky, President Trump told the delegation that they would have to, and I quote, talk to Rudy. It is worth pausing here to consider the importance of this meeting in late May. This is the moment that President Trump successfully hijacked the tools of our government to serve his corrupt personal interests. When the president's domestic political errand, as one witness famously described it, began to overtake and subordinate U.S. foreign policy and national security interests. By this point in the scheme, Rudy Giuliani was advocating very publicly for Ukraine to pursue the two sham investigations. But his request to meet with President Zelensky was rebuffed by the new Ukrainian president. According to reports about Ambassador Bolton's account, soon to be available, if not to this body, then to bookstores near you. The president also unsuccessfully tried to get Bolton to call the new Ukrainian president to ensure he would meet with Giuliani. The desire for Ukraine to announce these phony investigations was for a clear and corrupt reason, because President Trump wanted the political benefit of a foreign country announcing that it would investigate his rival. That is how we know, without a doubt, that the object of the president's scheme was to benefit his re-election campaign. In other words, to cheat in the next election. Ukraine resisted announcing the investigations throughout June, so the president and his agent, Rudy Giuliani, turned up the pressure, this time by yielding the power of the United States government. In mid-June, the Department of Defense publicly announced that it would be releasing $250 million of military assistance to Ukraine. Almost immediately after seeing this, the president quietly ordered a freeze on the assistance to Ukraine. None of the 17 witnesses in our investigation were provided with a credible reason for the hold when it was implemented, and all relevant agencies opposed the freeze. In July, Giuliani and the president's appointees made clear to Ukraine that a meeting at the White House would only be scheduled if Ukraine announced the sham investigations. According to a July 19 email, the White House has tried to suppress this drug deal, as Ambassador Bolton called it, was well known among the president's most senior officials, including his chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, and Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And it was relayed directly to senior Ukrainian officials by Gordon Sondland on July 10 at the White House. Everyone was in the loop. Although President Zelensky explained that he did not want to be a pawn in Washington politics, President Trump did not care. In fact, on July 25, before President Trump spoke to President Zelensky, President Trump personally conveyed the terms of this quid pro quo to Gordon Sondland, who then relayed the message to Ukraine's president. Later that morning, during the now infamous phone call, President Trump explicitly requested that Ukraine investigate the Bidens and the 2016 election. Zelensky responded as President Trump instructed. He assured President Trump that he would undertake these investigations. After hearing this commitment, President Trump reiterated his invitation to the White House at the end of the call. Now, no later than a few days after the call, the highest levels of the Ukrainian government learned about the hold on military assistance. Senior Ukrainian officials decided to keep it quiet, recognizing the harm it would cause to Ukraine's defense, to the new government standing at home, and to its negotiating posture with Russia. Officials in Ukraine and the United States hoped that the hold would be reversed before it became public. As we now know, that was not to be. As we have explained during the trial, The president's scheme did not begin with the July 25th call, and it did not end there either. As instructed, a top aide to President Zelensky met with Giuliani in early August, and they began working on a press statement for Zelensky to issue that would announce the two sham investigations and lead to a White House meeting. Now, let's be very clear here. The documentary evidence alone, the text messages, the emails that we've showed you, confirms definitely the president's corrupt, definitively, the president's corrupt quid pro quo for the White House meeting. Subsequent testimony further affirms that the president withheld this official act, this highly coveted Oval Office meeting, to apply pressure on Ukraine to do his personal bidding. The evidence is unequivocal. Despite this pressure, by mid-August, President Zelensky resisted such an explicit announcement of the two politically motivated investigations desired by President Trump. As a result, the White House meeting remained unscheduled, just as it remains unscheduled to this day. During this same time frame in August, the president persisted in maintaining the hold on the aide, despite warnings that he was breaking the law by doing so, as an independent watchdog recently confirmed that he did. According to the evidence presented to you, the president's entire cabinet believed he should release the aid because it was in the national security interests of our country. During the entire month of August, there was no internal review of the aid. Congress was not notified, nor was there any credible reason provided within the executive branch. With no explanation offered, and with the explicit, clear, yet unsuccessful quid pro quo for the White House meeting in the front of his mind, Ambassador Sondland testified that the only logical conclusion was that the president was also withholding military assistance to increase the pressure on Ukraine to announce the investigations. As Sondland and another witness testified, this conclusion was as simple as 2 + 2 = 4. If the White House meeting wasn't sufficient leverage to extract the announcements he wanted, Trump would use the frozen aid as his hammer. Secretary Pompeo confirmed Sondland's conclusion in an August 22 email. It was also clear that Vice President Pence was aware of the quid pro quo over the aid and was directly informed of such in Warsaw on September 1, after the freeze had become public and Ukraine became desperate. Sondland pulled aside a top aide in Warsaw and told him that everything, both the White House meeting and also the security assistant, were conditioned on the announcement of the investigations that Sondland, Giuliani, and others had been negotiating with the same aide earlier in August. This is an important point. The president claims that Ukraine did not know of the freeze in aid, though we know this to be false. As the former deputy foreign minister has admitted publicly, they found out about it within days of the July 25th call and kept it quiet. But no one can dispute that even after the whole became public on August 28th, President Trump's representatives continued their efforts to secure Ukraine's announcement of the investigations. This is enough to prove extortion in court, and it is certainly enough to prove it here. If that wasn't enough, however, on September 7, more than a week after the aid freeze became public, President Trump confirmed directly to Sondland that he wanted President Zelensky in a public box and that his release of the aid was conditioned on the announcement of the two sham investigations. Having received direct confirmation from President Trump, Sondland relayed the president's message to President Zelensky himself. President Zelensky could resist no longer. America's military assistance makes up 10% of his country's defense budget, and President Trump's visible lack of support for Ukraine harmed his leverage in negotiations with Russia. President Zelensky affirmed to Sondland on that same telephone call that he would announce the investigations in an interview on CNN. President Trump's pressure campaign appeared to have succeeded. 2 days after President Zelensky confirmed his intention to meet President Trump's demands, the House of Representatives announced its investigation into these very issues. Shortly thereafter, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community notified the intelligence communities that the whistleblower complaint was being improperly handled or improperly withheld from Congress with the White House knowledge. In other words, the president got caught. And 2 days later, on September 11, the president released the aid. To this day, however, Ukraine still has not received all of the money Congress has appropriated, and the White House meeting has yet to be scheduled. The identity of the whistleblower, moreover, is irrelevant. The House did not rely on the whistleblower's complaint, even as it turned out to be remarkably accurate. It does not matter who initially sounded the alarm when they saw smoke. What matters is that the firefighters, Congress, were summoned and found the blaze, and we know that we did. The facts about the president's misconduct are not seriously in dispute, as several Republican senators have acknowledged publicly. We have proved that the president abused his power in precisely the manner charged in Article 1. President Trump withheld a White House meeting and essential congressionally appropriated military assistance from Ukraine in order to pressure Ukraine to interfere in the upcoming presidential election on his behalf. The sham investigations President Trump wanted announced had no legitimate purpose and were not in the national interest. Despite the president's counsel's troubling reliance on conspiracy theories to claim the president acted in the public interest, the president was not focused on fighting corruption. In fact, he was trying to pressure Ukraine's president to act corruptly by announcing these baseless investigations. And the evidence makes clear that the president's decision to withhold Ukraine's military aid is not connected in any way to purported concerns about corruption or burden sharing. Rather, the evidence was presented to you is damning, chilling, disturbing, and disgraceful. President Trump weaponized our government and the vast powers entrusted to him by the American people and the Constitution to target his political rival and corrupt our precious elections, subverted our national security and our democracy in the process. He put his personal interests over those of the country, and he violated his oath of office in the process. But the president's grave abuse of power did not end there. In conduct unparalleled in American history, once he got caught, President Trump engaged in categorical and indiscriminate obstruction of any investigation into his evidence of his wrongdoing.
He ordered
from Congress
every government
and the American people. The president's obstruction was unlawful and unprecedented, but it also confirmed his guilt. Innocent people don't try to hide every document and witness, especially those that would clear them. That's what guilty people do. That's what guilty people do. Innocent people do everything they can to clear their name and provide evidence that shows that they are innocent. But it would be a mistake to view the president's obstruction narrowly, as the president's counsel have tried to portray it. The president did not defy the House's impeachment inquiry as part of a routine interbranch dispute or because he wanted to protect the constitutional rights and privileges of his presidency. He did it consistent with his vow to fight all subpoenas. The second article of impeachment goes to the heart of our Constitution and our democratic system of government. The framers of the Constitution purposefully entrusted the power of impeachment in the legislative branch so that it may protect the American people from a corrupt president. The president was able to undertake such comprehensive obstruction only because of the exceptional powers entrusted to him by the American people. And he wielded that power to make sure Congress would not receive a single record or a single document related to his conduct and to bar his closest aides from testifying about his scheme. Throughout the House's inquiry, just as they did during the trial, the president's counsel offered bad faith and meritless legal arguments as transparent legal window dressing intended to legitimize and justify the president's efforts to hide evidence of his misconduct. We've explained why all of these legal excuses hold no merit, why the House's subpoenas were valid, how the House appropriately exercised its impeachment authority, how the president's strategy was to stall and obstruct. We've explained how the president's after-the-fact reliance on unfounded and in some cases brand new legal privileges are shockingly transparent cover for a president dictate of blanket obstruction. We've underscored how the president's defiance of Congress is unprecedented in the history of our republic. And we all know that an innocent person would eagerly provide testimony and documents to clear his name, as the president apparently thought he was doing mistakenly when he released the call records of his two telephone calls with President Zelensky. And even as the president has claimed to be protecting the presidency, remember that the president never actually invoked executive privilege throughout this entire inquiry, a revealing fact given the law's prohibition on invoking executive privilege to shield wrongdoing. And yet, according to the president's counsel, the president is justified in resisting the House's impeachment inquiry. They assert that the House should have taken the president to court to defy the obstruction. The president's argument is as shameless as it is hypocritical. The president's counsel is arguing in this trial that the House should have gone to court to enforce its subpoenas, while at the same time, the president's own Department of Justice is arguing in court that the House could not enforce the subpoenas through the courts. And you know what remedy they say in court is available to the House? Impeachment for obstruction of Congress. This is not the first time this argument has been made. President Nixon made it too, but it was roundly rejected by the House Judiciary Committee 45 years ago. When the committee passed an article for obstruction of Congress for far less serious obstruction than we have here. The committee concluded that it was inappropriate to enforce its subpoenas in court. And as the slide shows, the committee concluded that it was inappropriate to seek the aid of the courts to enforce its subpoenas against the president. This conclusion is based on the constitutional provision vesting the power of impeachment solely in the House of Representatives and the express denial by the framers of the Constitution of any role for the courts in the impeachment process. Again, the committee report on Nixon's articles of impeachment.
Once we strip the president's obstruction of this legal window dressing, the consequences are as clear as they are dire for our democracy. To condone the president's obstruction would strike a death blow to the impeachment clause in the Constitution. And if Congress cannot enforce this sole power vested in both chambers alone, the Constitution's final line of defense against a corrupt presidency will be eviscerated. A president who can obstruct and thwart the impeachment power becomes unaccountable. He or she is effectively above the law. And such a president is more likely to engage in corruption with impunity. This will become the new normal with this president and for future generations. So where does this leave us? As many of you in this chamber have publicly acknowledged in the past few days, the facts are not seriously in dispute. We have proved that the president committed grave offenses against the Constitution. The question that remains is whether that conduct warrants conviction and removal from office. Should the Senate simply accept or even condone such corrupt conduct by a president? Absent conviction and removal, how can we be assured that this president will not do it again? If we are to rely on the next election to judge the president's efforts to cheat in that election, how can we know that the election will be free and fair? How can we know that every vote will be free from foreign interference solicited by the president himself? With President Trump, the past is prologue. This is neither the first time that the president solicited foreign interference in his own election, nor is it the first time that the president tried to obstruct an investigation into his misconduct. But you will determine whether it will be his last. As we speak, the president continues his wrongdoing unchecked and unashamed. Donald Trump hasn't stopped trying to pressure Ukraine to smear his opponent, nor has he stopped obstructing Congress. His political agent, Rudolph Giuliani, recently returned to the scene of the crime in Ukraine to manufacture more dirt for his client, the President of the United States. President Trump remains a clear and present danger to our national security and to our credibility around the world. He is decimating our global standing as a beacon of democracy while corrupting our free and fair elections here at home. What is a greater protection to our country than ensuring that we, the American people, alone, not some foreign power, choose our commander-in-chief? The American people alone should decide who represents us in any office without foreign interference, particularly the highest office in the land. And what could undermine our national security more than to withhold from a foreign ally fighting a hot war against our adversary? Hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid to buy sniper rifles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, radar, and night vision goggles, so that they may fight the war over there, keeping us safe here. If we allow the president's misconduct to stand, what message do we send? What message do we send to Russia, our adversary, intent on fracturing democracy around the world? What will we say to our European allies already concerned with this president about whether the United States will continue to support our NATO commitments that have been a pillar of our foreign policy since World War II? What message do we send to our allies in the free world? And if we allow the president's misconduct to stand, what will we say to the 68,000 men and women in uniform in Europe right now who courageously and admirably wake up every day ready and willing to fight for America's security and prosperity, for democracy in Europe and around the world? What message do we send them when we say America's national security is for sale? That cannot be the message we want to send to our Ukrainian friends or our European allies or to our children and our grandchildren who will inherit this precious republic. And I'm sure it is not the message that you wish to send to our adversaries. The late Senator John McCain was an astounding man, a man of great principle, a great patriot. He fought admirably in Vietnam and was imprisoned as a POW for over 5 years, refusing an offer by the North Vietnamese to be released early because his father was a prominent admiral. As you all are aware, Senator McCain was a great supporter of Ukraine, a great supporter of Europe, a great supporter of our troops. Senator McCain understood the importance of this body, this distinguished body, and serving the public, once saying, quote, "Glory belongs to the act of being constant to something greater than yourself, to a cause, to your principles, to the people on whom you rely and who rely on you." The Ukrainians and the Europeans and the Americans around the world and here at home are watching what we do. They are watching to see what the Senate will do. And they are relying on this distinguished body to be constant to the principles America was founded on and which we've tried to uphold for more than 240 years. Doing the right thing and being constant to our principles requires a level of moral courage that is difficult, but by no means impossible. It is that moral courage shown by public servants throughout this country and throughout the impeachment inquiry in the House. People like Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, her decades of nonpartisan service were turned against her in a vicious smear campaign that reached all the way to the president. Despite this effort, she decided to honor a duly authorized congressional subpoena and to speak the truth to the American people. For this, she was the subject of yet more smears against her career and her character, even as she testified in a public hearing before Congress. Her courage mattered. People like Ambassador Bill Taylor, a West Point graduate who wears a Bronze Star and an Air Medal for valor, and his proudest honor, the Combat Infantryman's Badge. When his country called on him, he answered again and again and again in battle, in foreign affairs, and in the face of a corrupt effort by the president to extort a foreign country into helping his reelection campaign, an effort that Ambassador Taylor rightly believed was crazy. His courage mattered. People like Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who came to this country as a young child, fleeing authoritarianism in Europe. He could have done anything with his life, but he too chose public service, putting on a uniform and receiving a Purple Heart after being wounded in battle, fighting courageously in Iraq. When he heard that fateful July 25th call in which the president sold out our country for his own personal gain, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman reported it and later came before Congress to speak the truth about what happened. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's courage mattered. To the other public servants who came forward and told the truth in the face of vicious smears, intimidation, and White House efforts to silence you, your courage mattered. You did the right thing. You did your duty. No matter what happens today or from this day forward, that courage mattered. Whatever the outcome in this trial, we will remain vigilant in the House. I know there are dedicated public servants who know the difference between right and wrong. But make no mistake, these are perilous times. If we determine that the remedy for a president who cheats in an election is to pronounce him vindicated and attack those who exposed his misconduct.
Hi, I'm Laura from Hudson at the Hudson Farmers Market. You're listening to
Senators,
WGXC ACRA.
I want to take a moment to say something about the staff
FM,
who have worked tirelessly
hands-on
on the
radio.
Impeachment inquiry and this trial for months now. There is a small army of public servants down the hall from this chamber, in offices throughout the House, and yes, in that windowless bunker in the Capitol, who have committed their lives to this effort because they, like the managers and the American people, believe that a president free of accountability is a danger to the beating heart of our democracy. I'm grateful to all of them, but let me mention a few. Daniel Goldman, Maher Batar, Rian Workla, Patrick Boland, William Evans, Patrick Fallon, Sean Misko, Nicholas Mitchell, Daniel Noble, Diana Pilipenko, Emily Simons, Suzanne Grooms, Krista Boyd, Norm Eisen, Barry Burke, Joshua Matz, Doug Letter, Sarah Istel, Ashley Etienne, Terry McCullough, Dick Meltzer, and Wendy Parker. Some of those staff, including some singled out in this chamber, have been made to endure the most vicious false attacks to the point where they feel their lives have been put at risk. The attacks on them degrade our